Good afternoon. Okay, so I'm going to take most of the time today on exam review for some notes. So one thing. So the test I wrote for Two-Face, I tested reordering so it made my implementation fail if I turned off my detection of reordered things, but apparently I wasn't clever enough to come up with enough scenarios to like actually make other people's implementations consistently fail. So just letting you know, that's the thing which happened, which was not intentional, but first time doing the assignment, you know, I didn't think, oh, what, people are gonna use different messages, so different sequences of messages, so it's gonna matter differently which message I delay, and I just didn't test all the correct which message to delay, when to delay it to scenarios. On that. So, unfortunately, not as complete as intended. And let's see. Office hour next week should be on the calendar. I will try to check tomorrow that there's no TAs who accidentally left something on there when they shouldn't have. But we should actually have office hours next week as posted, probably at different times because your TAs have finals, and I have different obligations next week, but we should have that. And, okay, otherwise, like we did for our midterm review, I'll take your questions you want me to talk about, and we'll write them down, and then we'll go through them in some order. So what do people want me to talk about? Yes? Which is about
calculating this minimum space required to store certain files. Also, is the exam held in this room?
Question is where location exam? Okay. Yeah.
The whole MF process is like a big thing in writing for the case with the cache and the case table part of the memory.
So the whole. That is not specific enough. I'm not gonna like redo a whole lecture. Like
using MF for like I don't remember exactly what it was, but
like I can talk about MMAP and how processes memory layout can be stored. I'll start with that. Like I need like there's enough subtopics there. I don't wanna like just give a high level overview and miss what you're actually confused about. Yeah.
From last lecture, the hypervisor. Can you just talk about from like the time a system call is made in the guest OS to the time that it receives it on the other side, like what mode the hypervisor is in and everything.
Is six, which is about. Can we be more specific?
Like how many pages would be necessary?
Okay. Yeah. I nodes. What and why? Okay. Yeah.
How to optimize memory layout on hard disk?
Okay. Laying out data on hard drives. Okay. Probably this goes. Okay, so let's start with fishing exam. As far as I know, it's here. Should be. If not, I would sure like to know that. Yes. Do page, can we be more specific?
Like the different
types, yeah. What, like, the pros and cons? I guess, yeah, okay. Different, like, pros, cons, types, generally, okay. But the official location should be on sys, which hopefully is actually accurate. Sys login, right. Sys, which is of course extremely slow, so why would I expect anything? Yeah, now 101. Yes, you can look this up on sys, by the way, for location. Okay.
Could we also cover like trees on disk and write ahead logging and journaling and like the process for that?
Disk, okay.
Order,
okay. I thought we were done collecting topics, but apparently not even close. Okay.
Can we see when pros and cons of access controls versus capability?
Okay. So let's pull up old quizzes. So quiz from spring 2018 quiz. Spring 2018 quiz.
It might be spring 2018. One second. Spring 2019.
Okay. I don't have that. Oh, right.
It's under study.
For old quizzes. Spring 2019 quiz. Okay. So, 6. Remember, question. Quiz 6?
Quiz 6, question 1, before it starts any program.
Okay. Do you, what? Fall 20?
The spring 2019 semester quizzes that he's looking at has a link to the fall 2018 quizzes in the study material, which is the one he's looking at.
Oh, okay. I see, so I haven't actually, okay, interesting. That's interesting to know. Okay, so this is really fall 2018 quiz 6, apparently. That makes more sense, okay. I was pulling up the source files, and yeah. So this is the quiz question. With the correct answer marked. So this was asking how much space do we need to set this up? So this is talking about setting up the kernel part of the page table. And so we're going, so what do we need for this? So we definitely need a first level page table, which will take up 4KB. Or I'll count pages, one page. And the best we could possibly do is one second level page table for each 1024 valid pages. And since we have 224 megabytes of memory divided by 4KB is going to be I take out my calculator. This was a quiz, notably. We would not expect you to actually do this. Well, we would hope not expect you to do, we would let you leave this unsimplified on an exam. Pages, valid pages, which is, if we divide that by 1,024, or 56 times 1,024 valid pages. So the best possible is 56 second level page tables for each of the distinct pages, or which requires 56 pages to store, since each one is one page. So the total, best possible total, is 57 pages. Now, I said best because the assumption, you know, best and would be worse than the best if we couldn't fill up all of each second level table due to the virtual addresses. But 0880 is at the start of a second level table. You know, I guess maps to the start of a second level table. So this won't be a problem. But if we like chose a slightly higher address, then we'd have that little, like the first table would have a little bit of stuff unused and that would spill over to require an extra second level page table potentially. Okay, some questions? Process, yeah.
Assuming that each one is 4 bytes, is that how that works? The 56 times 1024, you're assuming that every one.
So I know because it's 32-bit x86 that each page table takes up one page, which is 4K. And if we had it like a different size, I would need to figure out exactly what is it. I'm going to write down Quizlink. Okay. Interesting. Okay. Then we have mmap and so on. So the sort of Linux and common Unix way of storing what a process's memory looks like is as a list of regions that could have been created with mmap. So what does this mean practically? So on a page fault, look up which region to decide what to do. You know, e.g. copy on write, load from a file, allocate new zero pages, etc. So this is a storage a technique for representing what is the process's memory going to actually be, which makes more sense when we want to support things like memory mapping files, loading executables on demand, and things like that, which we didn't have like in XP6, where instead of having this mapping, we just had the end of the heap and the page table was our source of truth, sort of what a program's memory looked like. But here we're going to have sort of separate data structures for that. And we talked a bunch about like some of the possibilities for the separate data structures we would have. But the important thing is that, so on a page fault, we need to look up what to do. And we also needed to look up a physical page and find out where it is to update page tables on eviction. So we needed data structures that let us do that, and typically they'll be coupled with this map regions that are mapped, because for so you can save space, like if the same file is mapped into like three programs. Yes.
Does the memory that's mapped always contiguous, or is it like kind of
chopped? So the question is, the memory that maps always contiguous? So they store it as a list of those regions. So if they're not contiguous, you'll have two separate regions. Yes. Your question? Nope. Okay. Questions on this? Okay. So, page replacement algorithms. So I guess we had sort of, page replacement algorithms. The general goal is we're trying to guess what won't be accessed soon, / what will be accessed. We're trying to make that kind of guess in all our page replacement algorithms, because that's how we're going to, minimize the number of misses and also, just generally make things faster as far as not loading things we're not using and loading things we are using and so on. And typically, we assume that we want something close to LRU. LRU, because with NOST programs, this is a good approximation of the optimal guess for what will be accessed soon. With most programs, the least recently accessed thing is similar to the thing which is least likely to be accessed soon. So that's usually true, it's not guaranteed. So, typically we want that. So true LRU is not practical to implement because we have to do a bunch of work for each memory access to tell. So every time something's used, we need to update the order. The work equals update the ordering of pages. So we can always tell which is least recent. So that's just not practical, so we won't actually do that. So then we have approximations that, get close to this LRU model. And we talked about a few. There's a whole bunch we could come up with. And typically, so we have approximations based on looking for accesses during some period of time. And so one version of this was a second chance, that period of time equals since we last examined it for replacement. We had the Linux's seek policy. Since we put it on a list of inactive pages. Of active pages, and there's some other variations of this we can have. We also had some time, and the difference until the end. And there's also some variation about whether you try to react to the access immediately or wait until you need to look for an unaccessed page. So with second chance, we just recorded that it was accessed, but didn't use this until we needed a new page. And we started inspecting pages at the bottom of the list. Page, and it made it to the bottom of the list of pages. And with seek, we reacted soon after access while on an active list to remove it. And this page, and both of these choices are going to affect how closely it approximates LRU and also how much overhead it has. But these are all ways, of getting close to that without having the cost of really doing true LRU. Yes?
So you said if it gets accessed while it's on an active list, it will...
Yeah. Soon after. So the Linux policy is if it's accessed while on the inactive list, soon after it's just put to the active list, without regard to whether we're actually looking to do a page replacement right now.
So if it was accessed when it was on the active list,
nothing happens.
Nothing.
And that's an overhead choice because by choosing a different period of time, we're changing sort of how much work we're spending recording accesses and checking accesses. Okay. So we also mentioned some policies that went, I would say, beyond LRU. And so one version of this was policies that would try to heuristically detect patterns that LRU is a bad idea for. So we gave the example of Linux trying to detect files that are accessed only once. Because LRU is bad for that, because when we're accessed once, we'll say they're recently used, we should keep them around for a while, when in fact, if it's only going to be accessed once, we want to get rid of them kind of soon. Another example was being sort of eager replacement. And this example we gave for this is read ahead, guess future accesses before they happen. Future accesses before they happen. So this is beyond what the LRU replacement policy would do, even though we're going to probably use something LRU-like to figure out what to replace, but we're replacing extra stuff based on guesses about what's going to happen. And we need some non-LRU way of figuring out what that would be. Typically, this is based on patterns which are so regular that it's really obvious what's going to be accessed next, typically like reading a file from beginning to end, things like that. So questions on our page replacement policies? Okay. So then talking about often layout and hard drive. So generally, the general rule is want to keep related data in contiguous sector numbers. Hard drive hardware will make sure adjacent sector numbers are physically close, which implies lower seek times and rotational latency, which is that time to actually move the disk head to get the location. Yes. So the question is this different for SSDs? So optimal layout on SSDs. Block remapping happens, so it mostly doesn't matter. But one concern is sort of, how many writes you do is probably, is going to affect performance a bunch, right? Because the writes are a lot more expensive than a hard drive because we have to do that block rewrapping work. Matter also, nothing has to move physically, so adjacency doesn't matter much. It might matter a little bit because of how the block map is maintained and when things are erased, but doesn't matter nearly as much. And it might matter a little bit because sometimes the SSD has slightly larger units than the sectors, but it's not nearly the same thing as hard drives, where like you really want it contiguous to avoid moving the head back and forth over and over again. And I guess I should be clearer about related data. So by related data, I mean data that you will access together. So I don't mean like putting all the directory entries contiguously, not actually helpful, because you aren't just going to access all the directory entries on your entire hard drive at the same time. You're going to access the directory entries for a directory and the stuff in that directory. And you want those together, not just all the things of the same type or something like that. And inodes. So inodes have all the data information about a file on disk except for the name. So this is an alternative to the sort of more ad hoc FAT approach. Of splitting the information between directory entry and the FAT table. Now, sort of a challenge, though, is that challenge, what about, variable-sized files? And the solution is we have pointers to the extra information, which is extra info, which is the other locations of additional data blocks. Yeah. What? Why doesn't it store the name? Because that's in the directory. For the name. So the name is stored in the directory and a rationale is that we need to, when we're looking up a file, we want all the names we need to check together. Yeah.
So all you have is the inode number is the only way to get the name to search through all the directories until you find an inode that matches.
Question is, if all it has is the inode number, the only way to get the name is to search through all the directories until I find an inode which matches? Yes. Yeah.
What are some of like pros and cons of using inodes versus the FAT approach? Is there like reasons you would want to use one over the other?
The question is pros and cons. So I think most iOS designers would consider the ad hocness of the FAT approach kind of a mistake, in that that if you like want to move a file, you have to you don't have just one pointer you can move. But they probably wouldn't necessarily say that the sort of FAT table type separate data structure is necessarily bad. And there's just different choices. So I guess the big trade-off with inodes that FAT doesn't have is that typically you allocate them all at once, which means that you decide when you make the disk how many files you're going to support, and FAT doesn't do that. But if you really care about that, you could make your inode table size variable, which some file systems do. And I guess the second question is what's the best way to store a list of files? And we talked about things like extents and other alternatives, but that's kind of mostly orthogonal to whether you put all the file data in one place. Okay, then Q14A from fall 2019. So exam. So I probably should go to the actual website because of that. So fall 2018. A. Okay, so Q14 says we have a bunch of file systems, and it asks, so was storing a 1.5 kilobyte file in, and we'll start with A, inode-based file system, 256 byte inodes, with 5 direct pointers, 1 indirect, 1 double indirect, and 4 kilobyte blocks, 4 byte block pointers. And we asked about, and the question was space for data plus inodes plus other disk space that's out, the space allocated, but not including things like free block information. You have a question?
What about directory entries?
And not directory entries, explicitly not directory entries. Yes. So directory entries were explicitly excluded in the question. So. And we didn't even tell you their size to kind of give you a hint that you shouldn't talk about them. So, for that, so for this file, and we didn't have anything about supporting fragments or anything like that, so for this file, we're going to have to allocate 4K, allocate one block to store the data. So that's 4 kilobytes. And going to allocate one inode, which is 256 bytes, because it tells us explicitly to include that space. And in that inode, we will set a direct pointer. But that direct pointer is there, but the pointer is there regardless of whether we use it, so we don't count it. It's allocated regardless of whether we want to use it, along with all the other direct pointers in the inode. And so that gave us the correct answer, 4K plus 256 bytes. Then we had storing the same file in inode-based file system, but instead of block pointers, we have 10 extents in the inode, which store starting block number, length, and blocks. And we got the same answer. 6 bytes. We still need to allocate a block because the length is in blocks. So there's no possible way we can allocate less than a block. And all the length is in blocks, and because we have a free block map mentioned in the question that has a bit per block. So we don't have any way of allocating less than a block. Yes.
What's the next step?
Extent. So the extents are just this information, a starting block number and a block. So it just stores a list of those. So the idea is for a large file, which is 14B, we can store just one of these, assuming we can find a bunch of blocks that are all together. So rather than storing a pointer to each block, we store, if we have blocks 10 through 50, we just store 10, 40. Yeah. Can we do large file? We'll do that later. I'll add that to the end list because I don't anticipate getting there quickly. And the final part was storing it in FAT 32 with 4KB clusters. In this case, we allocate one 4KB cluster, and it asks for space for FAT entries plus file data. So 4KB plus 4 bytes for the FAT entry that said there, that said no next cluster, which would be set. And explicitly, but not directory entries, even though that's rather relevant to FAT32. Okay. Yeah, I'll get, yeah, so.
How much space does the one extent take up?
So we weren't, the question is how much space does one extent take up? The question didn't tell us, but it told us they were part of the inode. So they're in that 256 bit bytes that we counted as the inode. Okay, so then symbolic links. So symbolic links are either directory entries or special files that just contain the name of a different file. And when used, the operating system goes to that different file, looking it up by name. And since it looks it up by name, this means that it doesn't care if that file like changed where it is on disk and so on in the meanwhile. And if it's not there, you'll get an error. So unlike hard links, if the file is removed and created again, still works. Unlike hard links, doesn't keep the file around if the original is removed. Which that probably gives you the sort of pro-con, right? Hard link is really like a cop, like it's the same file that if you remove it, like the hard link will remember you wanted a copy here. With a symbolic link, you just have a pointer, which now is a dangling pointer. Removed. So hard links keep your copy around because they track a reference count. Yes.
So this is like two pointers are the same thing, and when you want to get rid of one, you just get rid of the one pointer, but you still have the other copy.
So with hard links, yeah, we have an actual pointer to the real file, and we keep track of each file keeps track of how many pointers there are. With symbolic links, it doesn't contribute. We don't keep track of what it points to. It doesn't contribute to that count. So we don't care if it goes away. We just get an error if we try to read it. I guess also, unlike hard links, with hard links, hard adds to a reference count in the inode. Unlike hard links, works across different mounts. With hard links, need to store an inode number which can't work across two file systems. So like if I have a USB stick, I can't have a hard link to something that's not on the USB stick, because on that file system it needs to have a directory entry with an IO number. And what's the IO number for something that's not on that USB stick? Who knows? But with symbolic links, it has a name, it's not a problem. E.g. Less spares between. So you could have a USB stick with a symbolic link to /bin/ls, which would work, even though that's going to be a different inode every system you plug it into. Yeah.
So if binls wasn't there, you just get an error back.
And if binls wasn't there, you just get an error when you try to use that. this. I didn't intend to spend so much time on symbolic links since they're more not, well, they probably take up a lot of time in the OS implementation, but they're not really a conceptually an important OS feature. Okay, so, okay, trees on disk. So, yeah, is if we want to store some order data structure on disk, and we can use a search tree. But we want to be efficient for HDDs and SSDs and read, write big sectors blocks at a time. So even for SSDs, like, you don't want to write 16 bytes. That's not going to work. That's much bigger units than it's used to dealing with. So the solution is a tree where each node has a bunch of children and a bunch of items. But otherwise works similar to a normal search tree. You know, you go to the leaf. Yeah, if you have, you know, four children, you know what value is, you know a value in between each of the four children and can compare to determine which one to go to when searching or adding a value. Yeah?
Does each node just represent where the blocks are, or do they actually store, like, the data from the file?
So this is used when we had an order structure. So most commonly, like in file systems, this is like for directory entries, for example. So in that case, our tree entries would probably store, like, you know, there's multiple options, but one option would be you store directory entries and also pointers to leaves of the tree, pointers to those further down in the tree at each level. And the leaves, you have null pointers. And when you add a directory, you just search down and change one of those null pointers. That's a simplification because there's a little extra work for balancing to make sure it's balanced. But
this is only for, like, finding entries in files for storing the data.
The question is, this is not for storing the data. So this is typically not for storing the data, though you could use, and some file systems do use the same approach for, like, finding the data by byte number, in which case you probably store a tree of pointers to bytes. So Linux, I mentioned in class briefly that extended 4 uses this for, they store extents, but if the list of extents is very large, they store it as a tree. Now, hopefully that doesn't happen very often, but, and that's not an unheard of, and there's other file systems which do that type of strategy. Then on journaling, so we talked about redo logging. So the idea is, our procedure in general is log what we are about to do, log that we really are going to do it, commit it, and then actually do it. So this is the redo logging, and we have our normal operation, then we have our recovery. Our recovery is check the log and see if we were really going to do it. If so, actually do it again. So note that we always log first in this scheme. There are schemes where we do something in a different way, but they're not redo logging. And it's called redo logging because on recovery, we redo whatever's in the log. We say redo. If everything actually worked and we just didn't know, we're redoing it. If everything didn't work, we're doing it for the first time. And that's summary for that. And that tells you the order. So like the quiz question about the order, like the important thing about the order is that you do all the logging, then you write down the commit that, yes, I'm really going to do it, and then you do all the operations. You don't mix that up, because otherwise on recovery, you don't have enough to actually get things into the correct state. Like you're going to have it, there will be some case where things are partially done if there's a crash. And you do this recovery procedure. Like you could probably make it consistent with a more complicated recovery procedure, but we've talked about like FS check being super expensive, and it's something we want to avoid. Okay. Then hypervisors and handling a system call in the guest OS. So our timeline is that guest OS application makes a system call. Then the hypervisor's system call handler runs because a system call happened while code was running, and the hypervisor, which will say for simplicity, equals host OS. We'll say hypervisor and host OS are the same just to keep things simpler. Like if the host OS does other things, it has like some mechanism of detecting, this is the case where I need to do the hypervisor version of the things versus the normal version of the things. System call handler runs, and the system call handler runs, and I guess I should say, hardware ran it, because that's what the system call instruction does. Then the hypervisor system call handler returns to the guest OS's system call handler in order to run it. Then the guest OS system call handler does whatever it wants to do for the system call. We'll assume that it doesn't require anything special, like let's say does whatever the system call requires. So in the simplest case, that might be something like get PID, in which case it's like copying PID. It could be something really complicated, in which case there'd be other things for the hypervisor to do. We'll say simple case, like it's get PID. So it's reading a PID from its memory, getting it back. Then so guest OS system call handler tries to return from the system call, and the hypervisor's protection fault handler runs because hardware detected that the privileged return from exception interrupt instruction was run in user mode. So then the hypervisor's protection fault handler is going to have to realize, oh, this is because we need to simulate this return from interrupt operation. So the hypervisor's protection fault handler returns back to the guest OS's application. By looking up where the guest OS is trying to return to. Yeah. the question is, don't we also have to switch page tables? Yes. So I guess when we're running the guest OS in kernel mode here, so at star equals running kernel mode, which implies a different page table than when running it in user mode. This is assuming, I guess, assumptions here. Assumption, trap and emulate, and we don't have special hardware support for page tables. So hardware can make this easier by, for example, giving us an extra protection bit in our page tables. That's actually a very simple thing to implement, or by implementing, you know, that lookup itself by with nested page tables. If it has nested page tables, which we mentioned briefly, very briefly, it's probably going to have a way of not having two versions of them. Okay, some questions? So then ACLs versus capabilities. So capabilities are token to access thing equals permission to access. Access thing. An example is open file descriptors act like this, and we can pass them between programs instead of using file names, etc. So the big pro is that it's, so one big pro from an implementation point of view is that, it's harder to forget to check a capability is valid than an access control list. So access control list, remember, list of users, etc., what we called protection domains that can do operations on object like a file. So it's harder to forget to check a capability than an access control list. You kind of have to check the capability because you have to look up the object, but you could imagine that if you make a sloppy system call implementation, you might forget, oh, I need to check if the user can access this file in addition to looking up the file. Another pro, I guess, we didn't actually talk about this much detail when we talked about Git capabilities. So another pro is that it's pro of capabilities. It's easier to delegate capabilities. So for example, e.g., if you want to give a set UID program a file, you just pass file descriptor, and that solves a whole bunch of annoyances we had with how do we make sure you can open the file correctly. It's easier to delegate it. It's also easy to give, e.g., if a user is running a server and you want them to read your file, you pass a file descriptor rather than fiddling with the ACL. So sort of the act of doing the operation might handle the permissions for free. So that's sort of, this sort of easier to delegate is one of the big things people like about capability-based systems. So kind of capabilities. So probably the biggest con, we didn't talk about this explicitly, is revocation. That, it's hard, very hard to stop for someone with a capability to stop having access to that file if you change your mind. File, etc., change your mind. There are capability systems which have ways of doing this, but this adds a lot of complication. Basically, what you conceptually have is a way of closing a file descriptor that a child process has because you forked from the parent, you know, something like that. Like, you can make that sort of mechanism, but it's not trivial, and it's more complicated than the semantics of adjusting access control lists. So revocation is the big con. The other is that naming is, you know, makes naming, etc., resources more difficult because it's kind of tied in there, tied into how you access it. So it makes, and even though you can pass capabilities, like commonly we like have names that we can conveniently print out and pass around without having to have a sort of special mechanism. So like, you know, can't have user pass capability by reading out a file name. You can't read out a file name from your screen, put it into another program, and pass a capability that way. There has to be something special going on. Questions about capabilities? Okay, so then back to Q14B. So Q14B was the same file systems, but a bigger file. So we had the, so it was a same question, but 16 megabyte file. So for file system A, we had, so file system A. So the inode-based file, inode, 5 direct, 1 inder, 1 double inder, and 4K blocks, 4 byte block pointers. So here, we had 16 megabytes for the data, and then we had to have how many direct pointers did we need? So we need 16 meg divided by 4KB is, I think I had this worked out, is about 2 to the 20 pointers. So it was right, it was 2 to the 24 bytes. So this is 2 to the 24, which we told you in the question, bytes, divided by 2 to the 12 bytes. So we had 2 to the 12, about 2 to the 12 direct pointers we needed in total. And some of those we're going to have indirect pointers to get to, 2 to the 12 indirect pointers. And if we think about, so I'm going to, let's say we're storing this all in indirect pointer blocks, which is not quite true, but we'll deal with that in a bit. So 2 to the 12 direct pointers, each block can hold 2 to the 10 pointers. So if we have 2 to the 12 direct pointers, so 4 blocks can hold 2 to the 12 pointers. So we need 4 indirect blocks. So 4 indirect blocks to hold these pointers. And then to point to those 4 indirect blocks, we also need 1 double indirect block to point to the last 3 of those, because we only have 1 indirect pointer in the IO. So that gives us 4 plus 1 blocks of extra data. Now, if you're being careful, you'll notice that we actually only need to store direct pointers. We have 5 direct pointers in the inode and 2 minus 12 minus 5 in indirect blocks. But each block holding 2 to the 10 doesn't save us a whole block if we subtract 5. So that doesn't like change the number. We just have a few unused spaces at the last indirect block. And we have a lot of unused spaces in the double indirect block because we have a double indirect block just to store those three extra indirect block pointers. Yes?
Why does the block hold?
Why is it told to the 10? Because we have 4K blocks and 4-byte pointers.
Okay.
So that's 1,024 pointers per block. So this gave us 16 meg plus, you know, 5 times 4K B for the, I guess 4 times 4KB for the indirect blocks plus 1 4KB for the double indirect block, plus 256 bytes for the inode because the question said to count that. Where did I put my... There we go. So, you're saying, draw that, and let's see if I got around correctly. So, we have our... So, we have our inode, and we have, you know, I should use a much smaller pen size. Let's try that again. So we have our maybe not quite that much smaller. We have our inode, which has sort of metadata about the file, and we have 5 pointers to blocks. So this is the first. These are our direct pointers in the inode. This is the first 4 times 5 KB of the file. And then we have, and this is the indirect pointer, which points to a block. So this is 1,024 pointers, each of which points to a block. And this points, so this in total is going to be the next 1,024 times 4KB. And then we have the double indirect, which points to a block, which has 3 valid pointers, and the rest of this is unused. And then we have a pointer to an indirect block, which again, this is the next 1024 x4kb, and here is another, and there are, you know, 2 more, but the last is missing 5 pointers. I don't know if that's a super helpful picture. Yeah.
And just to clarify, the inode doesn't store any actual file contents.
So, question is, the inode doesn't store actual file contents? In a traditional inode-based file system, it does not.
Okay.
That is an interesting design option that some file systems do choose to take advantage, but not in the type of inode-based file systems we've talked about. In these, you mean, what would be that?
The, so, all of those little blocks that you have towards the farthest right are all, just metadata about the file?
These blocks here are the actual data.
Oh, okay.
But they're not in the inode. Like, even the direct pointer ones are not in the inode. And we eventually go to the actual data and draw all of them because there's several tens of thousands, many thousands to draw. Yeah, I was going to do that. Yeah?
Just extend the
Question is, does extended 4 use block pointers or extents? I think it supports both, I'm not sure. I'm not sure, actually. I know extended 3 uses block pointers, but. Yeah.
One question that we learned this before was, why don't we just add a bunch more indirect? Why do we add the feature of double indirect?
Why don't we add a bunch more indirect? Why are we adding, I'll do here. So why double indirect and not direct and not two indirect pointers? So this is it's not a hard and fast rule, but the heuristic is that we're gonna have some much bigger files, and that's what matters. So you can come up with mixes, we're much bigger files to deal with. So you can come up with mixes of file sizes where having two normal indirect pointers would be a lot better. But that's not gonna handle the big files very well. And most we're saving is a block. It's a block by doing this, and that's not much for these big files. If it's multiple megabyte file anyways, by using two indirect pointers, you're saving a block, and that's usually not going to be very significant. Once you already know that you have a whole block of pointers already. So it's an invalid option to do that, and there are probably there are file systems which let you have that sort of space trade-off, but it's not commonly super useful. Other topics for. Yeah?
Just one more thing on the LRU. What's the difference between the LRU and the blade? What was the southern?
Okay, so the question is LRU versus blazeman, so I'll find. LRU. So close to LRU. So, optimal for number of replacements is Belady's min, I guess I'll just add this here. Optimal for number of replacements, which is Belady's min, is replace the thing which is going to be accessed furthest in the future, but this requires knowing the future. But at least recently used, doesn't know the future. That means it's sometimes wrong about what's going to be accessed furthest in the future. But that's the difference, yes.
For the hard drive, when you're talking about data access together, are you talking about working sets? Or?
Chris, when I'm talking about data access together, I'm talking about working sets? Yeah, I'm talking about the same kind of idea as working sets. It's not what we've identified as working sets because you have directory entries, which aren't things that programs load into their memory, but they're things the OS needs to load. Yeah. It's something like working sets, but yeah. Things you'll read at the same time is probably a better way of thinking about it, which is not quite the same as a working set, because a working set, you might have multiple things together that you didn't read at the same time. It's a very similar idea. And our usual intuition for doing that was that we put directories together because we're making a guess that probably different files in the same directory are accessed together. Okay, any other questions? Sure. Yeah.
Down at the bottom where you were talking about the direct and indirect, you had the metadata on the top. Is the space allocated for the direct pointers always constant?
Question, is the space allocated for the direct pointers always constant? In an inode-based file system, we generally, there are direct pointers in the inode, and you have to allocate a whole inode to a file. You don't have any other choice. So you have that space whether you use it or not. So the file system chooses this when it, so the file system chooses the number of direct pointers in the inode, but basically once you choose the layout of the inode, if you just have an array of those, like, they're all the same. Like, certainly, this is one of those things where you could imagine making file systems which don't work that way, and that might even be a good idea, but it's not the ones we talked about. Okay, so I guess since this is the last lecture of the semester, some other logistical notes. So I need TAs next semester. If you didn't notice, there are 240 people registered for OS next semester and a wait list of about 20. So if you'd like to either apply or email me, but I won't look until after I get final, figure out, until after I figure out final grades. I'm just not gonna look, like, gonna figure out final grades first, but I do actually need people. I have a lot of returning TAs, but you know, it's bigger class, assuming I don't convince everyone to drop or something. So, yes. Not there, and thank you for a good semester.